So demagogues, well, personally, we may dislike them. I dislike a lot of personal traits that Trump has, but he reached those people who were being dominated by the elites, and he struck a responsive chord in them. And I think that's what Rothbard is getting at. We don't love the demagogue, but we love the fact that the demagogue has gotten around the elites.
Join the best in the movement. It's Conservative Conversations with ISI, educating for liberty since 1953.
Welcome back. You're listening to Conservative Conversations with Tom Cerouf. Our guest today is Dr. Joseph Salerno, who received his PhD in economics from Rutgers University. He is professor emeritus of economics in the finance and graduate economics department in the Lubin School of Business of Pace University in New York City, as well as the editor of the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics and the academic vice president of the Ludwig von Mises Institute, where he held the inaugural Peterson Luddy Chair in Austrian Economics. He also holds the John V. Denson II Endowed Professorship in the Economics Department at Auburn University. He's the author of many articles, essays, and books, and is joining me today to dive into the work and thought of Murray Rothbard and Austrian economics. So thanks for coming on the podcast, Dr. Salerno. It's great to have you.
It's my pleasure, Tom. Thank you for having me.
And before we continue with our interview, I'd like to thank you for listening to Conservative Conversations. This podcast is a production of the Intercollegiate Studies Institute, and our mission is educating for liberty. If you'd like to join us in fulfilling this mission, make sure to head over to Apple Podcasts to rate and review this podcast to help us reach more listeners like yourself. So, Dr. Salerno, we want to focus our episode today on the work and thought of Murray Rothbard and his scholarship, but I think it'd be impossible to do that without discussing the Austrian School of Economics. You know, for our ISI honors program, I remember reading Wilhelm Rupke's, some of his essays, as well as that of Friedrich Hayek. And when you read their writings, you know, they're championing freedom, free markets. They critique government intervention in the economy. I think it's Hayek who's famous for the knowledge problem, though I'm sure he's not the first to make that observation. But if to start off, if you could help sort of ground our discussion and help our listeners and myself understand further what people mean when they talk about Austrian economics, especially as how that differentiates between other schools, say that of the classical school or supply side Keynes. So what is Austrian economics?
Austrian economics began in 1871. It was actually founded by Karl Menger, a great intellectual figure in the history of economic thought and in intellectual history in general. But to make a long story short, Menger, who was a journalist, was watching the markets and noticed that the explanation of how prices were determined, that is, by the cost of production, was completely wrong, because prices in the markets were changing from day to day, from moment to moment, if you were talking about commodity markets or stock markets. So he came up with another explanation for that. And what he did was, without going into a lot of detail, he traced back the determination of prices to people's subjective wants and their choices and actions based on how important they believe these different wants were. So Austrian economics has since grown tremendously since Menger's time and basically traces all economic phenomena, business cycles, firms, markets, even money, back to the actions of individuals. It's sometimes called the method of a methodological individualism, but it's really a broader method. I hate to use the term, big terms here, but praxeology, which is simply the study of action. So it uses this praxeological method, starting from the actions of individuals and then deducing logically, step by step, how prices are determined, where money comes from, you know, how interest rates and rents are determined, and so on.
Okay. And one of the things I'm not super familiar with Austrian economics, so this is a great learning opportunity for me as well. But I was reading up a little bit in preparation for the podcast, and one of the things that came through was a difference or a distinction between economic history versus that of theory. So it sounds that Austrian economics is a theoretically, though you did mention just praxeology, so it's, but a sort of, I guess, a theory of praxis. So what's the distinction there, if you could draw that out further? And I think that might also speak to what you were saying about how a lot of economists maybe are missing the mark on the value of prices or something like that. So if you could.
So Austrians aren't against economic history. In fact, they do it. I mean, Murray Rothbard, we'll talk about, wrote a book on America's Great Depression, what caused it. And that's a great historical episode. But the difference for the Austrians between economic theory and economic history is a difference in method. So when you're doing economic theory, when you're trying to explain how prices arise, when you're trying to explain, you know, what entrepreneurs do, what you do is it's based on general experience. That is, we all know that we act, and we all even can understand that other people act. And to the Austrian, that simply means that they purposefully use means to achieve their most important ends. And from that insight, Austrians, and Rothbard in particular, can deduce all of the implications of that into a whole theory, construct a whole theory of economics. So we're not saying it's mystical or that it, you know, it's just all in your head. What we're saying is that you can use logic to, based on some basic facts of reality, of both subjective and objective reality, you can deduce the whole of economic theory. Then now economic history comes in explaining how certain things occur, how the banking crisis, the recent banking crisis occurred, or how the America's, what would cause America's Great Depression, or what caused the Great Depression of the 1930s. That's an application of the theory that was worked out prior to the individual concrete episodes of history. And one other thing I might want to add, Austrians do not believe that you can test the theory by looking at facts. In fact, the facts are dumb, as we say. The facts don't speak to us. The facts have to be interpreted. And the only way to interpret those facts is through a body of theory.
Okay, that's making sense. And then I guess if the theory of economics is drawn from an understanding of human action and subjective value that we each have, which maybe I'd love to actually hear you delve a bit more and sort of, I guess, concretize what that means, the subjective value of each individual person. But I guess, so the question is two parts. I'd love to see more, you explain more, like what that actually looks like in practice, or what the subjective value means as opposed to objective value. But then also how politics and how economics is related to politics, if we understand that politics also draws on basic facts about the human person.
All right, let me talk about some subjective value for a moment. The Austrians were the first, well, I mean, there were a few others before them, but the Austrians resolved through their theory the what's called the paradox of value. Why is it that diamonds, which cater to frivolous human needs and, you know, just conspicuous consumption, are much more valuable than bread or water, which are used to keep human beings alive? And the Austrians pointed out that it's a matter of the scarcity of the thing and the value and the importance of the want that it serves. So for people someone in a desert who has a diamond worth $20 million, the Graff pink diamond, which was sold for $46 million at auction a few years ago, that person, if he or she has not had water in 2 or 3 days, would trade that diamond for a gallon of water. The cost of production of the water and the diamond have nothing to do with it, with determining the price. The price is paid because people have reverse values. So in a normal situation, of course, a diamond is much more expensive than a gallon of water or a loaf of bread. And the reason being that bread and water are so abundant, fortunately for us, that the very lowest want that it serves for us has a very low value. And that's the value of every unit of water. Because if you lost one unit of water, if you lost a gallon of water, if you lost a loaf of bread, it wouldn't deprive you of something that was very important to you at that point. Whereas if you lost a diamond, in a normal situation, it certainly would. So I give my students the following example. If you've ever seen the movie Witness with Harrison Ford, which is about takes place in the Amish country in southeastern Pennsylvania. The Amish are a sect, a religious sect, that really are against any sort of conspicuous consumption. They don't even have buttons on their clothes. They have hooks and eyelets. But for the Amish, a diamond would be worth zero. An Amish would not pay even a penny for a diamond because that's something that's considered showing off and so on. So that's subjective value. If all Americans suddenly took on the values of the Amish, then what would happen would be that the price of diamonds would collapsed to zero. The high wages of jewelers and others, and also the prices of diamond mines, if they couldn't be used for anything else, would all be zero. So what Menger pointed out was that the value of the ends determined the value of the means. So its prices determine costs, not the other way around. And that's the classical school. The classical school believed that because the cost, a diamond had a high value because it cost a lot to dig a diamond out of the earth. But that's certainly not the case. Whether you find a diamond on a beach or you dig it out of the earth at great cost, it's going to have the same price if it has the same quality and the same desirability to people.
Okay. Well, with that primer in mind, let's turn to Murray Rothbard. And I guess an opening salvo would be, you know, who is Murray Rothbard? What is he about? And how does he situate himself, or how is he situated within the School of Austrian Economics?
Okay, let me just point out that Patrick Newman, a professor at Florida Southern College, and myself are writing a book on Rothbard and how he developed as an economist. So we've been looking at a lot of his archives. But Murray Rothbard was a student of Ludwig von Mises, who's really, I would say, the dean of the modern Austrian school. Mises' book, Human Action, which was published in 1949, really saved the Austrian school from just disappearing. And Rothbard carried on Mises' tradition. I think he went in a number of ways. He went beyond Mises, which we'll talk about. So Rothbard was a libertarian before he came to read Mises. He was very dissatisfied with the mainstream economics he was learning at Columbia University, which was either institutionalism, which kind of denigrates all economic theory, and he was also learning the emerging Keynesian economics and mainstream microeconomics. So he was dissatisfied with them. But he found out through the Foundation for Economic Education, which was a libertarian institution, a very venerable one, that there was Ludwig von Mises was in the United States, was writing a book that would appear within a few months. To make a long story short, Rothbard got in touch with Mises, read very quickly through Human Action, and became converted to Austrian economics almost immediately. He wrote Mises a letter when he was halfway through the book saying, this is economics whole. This is what I had been searching for. So that's sort of his background. He came from parents who were Jewish immigrants, and our grandparents that were Jewish immigrants. And most of his family were communists, except for him. He was not. So when there was a big discussion of the Spanish Civil War, everyone was bashing Francisco Franco, who was the leader of the rightist movement that was fighting the so-called loyalists, who were really just communists. And so he was a 9-year-old or a 10-year-old, and he says he remembers piping up when they were bashing Franco. What's wrong with Francisco Franco? So he was a libertarian from a very young age.
Well, that's interesting. It's just because my understanding of Franco is, and maybe I have the history wrong here, but that Franco was more authoritarian, right? Not necessarily, a Nazi or a fascist like Hitler or Mussolini, but certainly not somewhat of a libertarian ilk.
You know, this is anticipating what we might talk about after, but I will say Rothbard points out that Franco and also Augusto Pinochet from Chile, who also overthrew a communist dictator, are hated by the left. They're more hated than Hitler. And he puzzled over that, and he came to the conclusion, the reason why they're more hated than Hitler was because they overthrew social democrats. They overthrew the people who were elected, leftists who were elected through democracy. And democracy is a great god of the left. And that's why they're so hated. And by the way, that's why Trump, Bolsonaro, Orban, Milano in Italy, that's why they're so hated, even more than Franco and Pinochet, because they got elected, through a reactionary movement. And that's what the left hates, the fact that democracy was actually not working in their favor to progress towards a socialist utopia.
So just while we're on the subject of Rothbard's politics, I read your article, Rothbard versus the Progressives. And one of the things that he called for, one of the things that you described in that article is about how Rothbard in the 90s called for a new realignment of our politics, and what he called for was a reactionary right. So can you explain to us, what's the reactionary right? What's the realignment all about now in the 90s? And who's in and who's out of that coalition amongst, I guess, the existing groups, political groups at the time?
Yeah. So in the 1990s, the aftermath, of course, of the fall of the Soviet Union and the collapse of the Eastern Bloc, and Rothbard recognized that the Cold War was no longer an issue necessarily dividing, let's say, traditional and cultural conservatives on the one side and rational libertarians, sort of right wing or mainstream libertarians on the other side. So what he called for was a fusion of these two groups, because neither of these groups were progressive. Neither of these groups believed that there can be a heaven on earth that, you know, I forget what Buckley called it, was the imminentizing of the eschaton, the bringing down to earth of, you know, of sort of a heavenly environment. So Rothbard, very, very vigorously called for this realignment. And this is right before he died. I mean, in the 3 or 4 years before he died, he wrote a number of very important articles setting out this new strategy. People who were in were the non-progressives. The people who were out were the progressive politicians and their cronies. I mean, he was, you know, in the business world, that was beginning, the high tech stuff was beginning then. In particular, he focused the political canons from our side on the Clintons at the time. And he made a very important political point, and that was that we have to make what we have to attack the people who are actually in power at the time, because especially if they are defective individuals, if they have personalities that are, you know, like Clinton did and Hillary did, because once you know, people loathe, you know, his philandering and so on. But that then would lead you to look more closely at his politics and to see that they go together. And so Rothbard said the greatest nuclear fusion in politics is fusing the personal with the political, the personal hatred, the hatred of the man or the woman with the hatred of their ideological position and the insight that what they're trying to do is to impose their values, their corrupt, rotten values on us.
Okay. And one of the other things that I found, so especially it's great that we're recording today. Last night is the Trump indictment comes down, and Trump was often called a demagogue 2016 and in 2020. But Rothbard actually, and this is, I think, the first time I've ever heard someone say that demagoguery is a good thing, but he even calls for demagoguery. And so I found that very interesting, because I think maybe a lot of conservatives would bristle at the notion that our political hopes would rest in the hands of just, you know, one man or one woman who's has a lot of political charisma and is able to move the people. I think of John Adams as the famous, often cited quote: "We've created we've created a government of laws, not of men." But what's his thinking there on why demagoguery is good and necessary?
He wrote that an article on demagogy in 1954, and then later on brought it back up again, the demagoguery that you're talking about. Well, look at Trump. I mean, Trump was rhetorically brilliant. He brought back the phrase America First, which had been tainted with, you know, dark hints of Nazism and you know, being against the American crusade in World War II and so on. But yet, as a demagogue, he started a movement. Trump didn't have any more power than any of the other presidents before him. But what he did do was to reach around and short-circuit the elites and their control of the legacy media. So demagogues, though personally we may dislike them, I dislike a lot of personal traits that Trump has, but he reached those people who were being dominated by the elites, and he struck a responsive chord in them, and I think that's what Rothbard is getting at. We don't love the demagogue, but we love the fact that the demagogue has gotten around the elites. And he pointed out Joe McCarthy was someone who was like that, though he didn't agree with his ends. He said he agreed with his means, because McCarthy was a cold warrior too. But he just used means that, you know, he especially attacked the bureaucracy and U.S. Army. And when he did that, he was pretty much finished.
And then I think Rothbard's known for coining the term anarcho-capitalism. And sort of course, that's part of the libertarian discourse, I guess. What is anarcho-capitalism as opposed to, I don't know, just regular capitalism? What is anarcho-capitalism?
Well, laissez-faire. Well, Rothbard was reacting to laissez-faire. He used to be a laissez-faire capitalist when he was younger. And some of his socialist friends that he argued with at Columbia University said, well, if you don't want the government to run steel mills, why do you want the government to provide protection? And so Rothbard, of course, turned that on its head and realized, no, we can have governance structures and protection structures and protection against foreign invasion that is provided by the market. So anarcho-capitalism, we're not in favor of anarchy in the strict sense or the conventional sense of that term. We're in favor of anarchism, that is, without government. But that doesn't mean without governance structures. With every property owner would have rules for their own property. For example, Disney World doesn't have much crime. They're very good at providing protection for their paying customers. Hotels, malls, and so on. What we're saying is to allow all property to be private. And once that's done, then the property owner will be responsible for the protection of himself and his guests and clients and visitors and so on. So it's not as radical as it sounds. I think it's, to me, since I am an anarcho-capitalist, it's common sense. But I'm certainly willing to be comrades with people who want a limited government, people who want our old republic back. I mean, I think now's not the time to stress these differences. Now's the time to take America back, to go back to the old republic, or to go back even to the 1950s to begin with. Okay, then of course, as anarcho-capitalists, we push it further, but that's something we can discuss.
That's very interesting. I guess one of the things that that comes to mind is perhaps an objection would be like foreign policy. How does foreign policy, I think like most prescient today would be like, how are we going to deal with China without some sort of more overarching coalition, or what would I guess a government structure like a federal government that would have to take steps in order to push back against a creeping Chinese insurgency that's rising to, and I think they'd certainly want hegemony over us. So I wonder what the anarcho-capitalist rejoinder to stopping a country like China would be.
So to begin with, we would say we need a national divorce as a movement towards anarcho-capitalism. I mean, it's not practical to say we're going to jump into anarcho-capitalism. I know I'm temporizing here, but if we had many independent states in the United States, there's nothing stopping an alliance against foreign invaders. And the same thing would be true under anarcho-capitalism. There would be a few big insurance firms and other types of agencies that would provide protection. And look, we would have, because the government's so inefficient and also takes so much in taxes and reduces our wealth, we'd be a lot wealthier. We'd have better and more sophisticated weaponry. We're not saying to disarm. Anarcho-capitalists aren't necessarily pacifists, though maybe a tiny minority may be. So that's, again, something that we can talk about. But I think the key is to stop the left in the United States, not to worry about the Chinese right now. I mean, they're out there, but the threat to our liberties, the threat to our livelihoods, even the threat, I mean, to our freedom, not being thrown in prison for things that aren't crimes, is the progressive left, and they have to be stopped.
Fair enough. I guess to talk about Rothbard as the economist, you mentioned that towards the beginning that Rothbard was a student of Ludwig von Mises and then a contemporary of many of the other Austrian school scholars, including yourself, including Hayek. And as I understand it, he had a number of disagreements with Hayek about various points of of, I guess, politics and economics. I think he even called Hayek's, he wrote a review calling Hayek's Constitution of Liberty, quote, an evil book. So what is the nature and scope of the disagreements of between Hayek and Rothbard, and who would you say is best vindicated in those debates?
Okay, so there's, on the economic side first, in business cycle theory, Hayek was a great business cycle theorist. That is, he explained how inflation almost always led to recessions. However, his disagreement with Rothbard there was Hayek believed that business cycle theory was endogenous. And all I mean by that inflation and recession could come from the market economy, as well as being caused by government expansion of the money supply. But he thought that banks were part of the market economy, fractional reserve banks, and that they could cause on their own a business cycle. It may not be as deep or as destructive, as destructive as a business cycle caused by government, the central bank increasing the money supply. But it would be generated by the market. Rothbard opposed that view, and I think he showed in America's Great Depression through his economic theory that all business cycles are exogenous. That is, they're caused by factors outside the market economy, basically by government intervention into the monetary system through its central banks. So that was one disagreement with Hayek. It wasn't a very big disagreement. Another disagreement with Hayek had to do with the socialist calculation debate, which I kind of got involved in 1989, 1990. I wrote an article that influenced Rothbard quite a bit, and then he wrote a very good article on it. But bottom line is that Hayek believed that the problem with socialism was that there was so much knowledge out there that you needed to run an economy, and it was all dispersed. Well, that's certainly true, but Rothbard and myself and other Austrian economists believe that the real problem was what Mises initially pointed out, and that was calculation. That is, entrepreneurs all have different knowledge, that's all true. But the way to bring that knowledge together, or it's not really knowledge itself that we have right now. It's trying to forecast the future. So basically, how does an entrepreneur operate? He operates by trying to figure out what prices of the goods he wants to produce will be in the future under uncertainty, and then to use those prices to bid for the things that he needs to produce those goods. If the prices he expects exceed the cost of buying the things that he needs, the factors to make those goods, well, then he'll undertake the project. So what Mises said was that under socialism, because the state owns all the factors of production, all the material factors of production, you know, all the capital goods and the land and so on, that there is no market, so there's no prices. There's no prices for those things. So we never know what the costs of what we're producing. So we produce inefficiently, we produce the wrong things. That is not a knowledge problem. That's what we call a calculation problem. Sure, you do need knowledge about what's happening right now, but to focus on that and make that the main problem of socialism, Rothbard thought was wrong. I think that was wrong also. And I think our side, because there are some Hayekians who take his position, I think our side of the in Austrian economics got the better of that debate, though there are other people, some of whom are friends of mine, who would say otherwise. Now, let me get to the difference between Rothbard and Hayek on politics. The reason why Rothbard called that an evil book, and it was in a letter, he was much more favorable toward the book in his regular published writing, was on the one hand, Hayek, who had written a great book, The Road to Serfdom, came out in favor of a sort of a welfare state in the later chapters of that book. And Mises also criticized him for this in a review of the book. And Hayek was in favor of a universal basic income, basically. Today, of course, they don't want it to be means tested. They don't want any work requirement, as Hayek did. But so that was one thing that Rothbard took issue with. The other thing was Hayek's definition of coercion. For Rothbard, coercion is simply the use of physical force or the threat of the use of physical force in an aggressive manner, in a manner that invades property rights. So he was in favor of negative liberty. Liberty was a negative thing, was to leave people alone. Hayek also said that he was in favor of negative liberty, and in a way he was, but he had a very fuzzy, confused concept of what what coercion was. And that was that it was the actions taken by one man, he used the term man, to get another man to do things against that man's will. And he said, yes, coercion by government is one form of coercion, or physical force by government is one form of coercion, but there are other forms. And he even pointed out that a continually nagging wife will cause that man to change his choices and actions. And so that's he didn't want that outlawed, but it's a form of coercion. He had a very broad and confused notion of coercion. And I think that's why Rothbard in a letter, remember, not the published work, called it an evil book.
Okay, that makes sense. So there's some, I guess, differences of not only technical economic issues, but also some, even maybe some broad first principles and their relations to politics. And I want to ask then, how did you first get interested in Rothbard's work and then within the Austrian school as well?
I told a story in an article I wrote about how I became a libertarian, but very briefly, when I was I was 12 years old, my mother's cousin came to visit us from Italy, and it was a very pleasant visit until my father found out that he was a card-carrying member of the Italian Communist Party. So my father, they got to a big argument, so that really influenced me. So I started reading about communism when I was 12 years old, and I became a real anti-communist. And then the Goldwater campaign came about, a very pro-Goldwater. So I was very conservative initially. And then when I went away to college, I heard about this sort of movement called the Libertarian Movement, which was breaking off from the conservative movement at the time. And I picked up on that. I was reading Ayn Rand too, though she didn't use the word libertarian. So I was becoming a Randian. But then I quickly realized that there was something more than Rand, because Rand wasn't focused on politics as much. And she was focused on virtues that I didn't think were virtues, having a Catholic background. So I didn't think selfishness was particularly a virtue. So anyway, I read an article, a very famous article that really hit a lot of people like at my age, was an article in the New York Times magazine, Sunday magazine, I guess it was called then, about a radical right-wing alternative, and it was libertarianism, a radical right-wing alternative. And it was two students at Columbia who had written the article, and at the end they mentioned the Austrian School of Economics, which today, the dean of which today is Marian Rothbard. Mises was still alive, but he was at that point very ill. So I got all Rothbard. Somebody gave me a little pamphlet by Rothbard on how what causes depressions, and within 45 minutes I was converted to Austrian economics, and so that's how I got into it. And then when I became the vice when I graduated from college, I became the vice president of the New Jersey Libertarian Party, and I invited Rothbard, who just lived across the river, to come and speak. And when he found out that I was a graduate student in economics, he was very excited and hooked me up with some people that had a reading group in New Jersey. And then after a few months, they invited me to come to his living room. And so I was very, very nervous. But he interviewed me, but in a very friendly, pleasant way, just to find out how hardcore I was. But when I came to the door, I was very nervous. Someone brought me who already knew him. But he said, when he saw me, he said, "Joe, my boy, how are you?" He had only seen me once, and he made me feel right at home. He was just a great man and a great friend. I became very good friends with him later.
Yeah, when I was doing some reading on Rothbard in preparation for the podcast, I came away with the impression that he was quite a character and quite someone that attracted people to him and that you wanted to be around. But we're unfortunately running out of time. So my last question for you would be, what do you see his legacy being as a political theorist, as an economist? Our colleague Dan McCarthy gave a special lecture to the staff at ISI, and he talked about how there are new debates emerging within the libertarian movement of the conservative movement. And he's mentioning that there are rifts within libertarianism today. So What do you make of those debates? What do you think Rothbard would say? And how is his spirit still being suffused throughout libertarianism in our current moment?
No, that's a great question. As an economist, I think his legacy as a cop and as an economist is great. But having read his stuff from the 90s again, I realized how willing to adjust his means to achieve libertarianism, how oriented he was towards that, towards, you know, we have to adjust our view of the political spectrum. So to make a long story short, I think Rothbard would be pro-Trump. Trump being a great demagogue, not being someone you would want, you know, who you would support all of his political positions. But I think you'd be happy with the MAGA movement. He would see that as a way of the ruled, the people who are being subjected to the elite, finally losing what Marx called their false consciousness. That we're finally seeing that these people want to lord it all over us, want to take our money, and want to impose their culture, which is a lot different from you know, old fashioned American culture, which Rothbard loved. Trying to impose their cultural mores on us. So I think he would also, I think he has a political legacy. It's still alive, and I'm here at the Mises Institute, and we're keeping his spirit alive, both in economics and in his political philosophy. I wouldn't say politics, because we're not a political organization, but we certainly are people who support his political philosophy.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today, Dr. Salerno. We'll put a link to the Mises Institute website in our show notes, and I appreciate how much all the stuff that they produce, and they give away, I think, all of their books for free as PDFs, which I think is a great thing, a lot of learning resources. But if people want to stay up to date specifically on all of your work, where should they look for you?
Well, I blog on the Mises website, so you can look there. I also have, as I pointed out before, a book that should be published next year with Patrick Newman on Murray Rothbard, The Making of an Austrian Economist. So look for that book. That will certainly be up on the Mises website. And I also want to put a plug in for my book on Austrian monetary theory, Money, Sound and Unsound.
Excellent. Well, thanks again, Dr. Salerno, and thank you to our listeners for listening to Conservative Conversations with ISI. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please feel free to head over to isi.org/resources to see all that we offer our members, including the Intercollegiate Review, select Modern Age articles, ISI books, and of course, this podcast. Thanks again for listening. Don't forget to rate and review, and we'll see you next time on Conservative Conversations with ISI.